noticed, today our country is having a special celebration. It's an anniversary, it's a birthday celebration, if you will. We here in the United States are still a free people, and we celebrate that freedom every 4th of July. One of our nation's founding documents is called the Declaration of Independence. In that Declaration of Independence are these words: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." That liberty, for the most part, still exists, and we are still a nation of free people. Turn with me, if you would, to Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy chapter 5. What's interesting about the Declaration of Independence and what took place in 1776 and the years surrounding that is that our nation's founders, the people that founded this country and signed that Declaration of Independence, realized the importance of freedom being based upon the laws, the rules, and the guidance of God. And that was the premise by which all of this was created. When I was about 12 years old, my dad took me and my brothers and I don't even think my sister was born at the time, on a family trip to Washington, D.C. Many of you have been there, I know. I wasn't too interested in history at the time, so I didn't pay too much attention, and I was really bored with some of the things we went and saw. But still, it made an impression on me. As I recall, just about any place you look in Washington, D.C., on almost any building, you find scripture written on almost every unit, no matter where it is, no matter what it is. Scripture is all over the place in that city. That includes the Capitol building, which is where the Supreme Court meets, interestingly enough. Yep, the same Supreme Court that came down with that infamous decision a week or so ago about same-sex marriage. As I recall it, when you walk up the steps to the Capitol building, you can see near the top of the building a row of statues. A row of statues representing some of the world's greatest lawgivers all through history, all lined up across the top of the Capitol building. In each of those statues is facing a statue that's in the middle of them all. The one statue facing forward with a full frontal view. Any idea who that middle statue is? It's Moses. A statue of Moses holding the Ten Commandments. Lawgivers from history. Statues of them all focused on one statue in the center, the statue of Moses holding the Ten Commandments. The way I remember it, as you enter the Supreme Court itself, which I had the opportunity to do when I went in there, I was really taken aback by how large the two enormous oak doors are that allow you to enter into the Supreme Court chamber. But on the lower portion of each giant oak door is an engraving. One door has one stone of the Ten Commandments, the other door has the other stone engraved in it of the Ten Commandments. Now, why would they design the Supreme Court like this? If you were to sit anywhere inside the courtroom, which was what I was able to do, you could see on the wall right above where the Supreme Court justices sit, all nine of them. There's a bench up there where they sit up when they hold court. And just above them on the back wall is a plaque of the Ten Commandments. Again, why would the Supreme Court be designed like this? Because as a nation of liberty and a nation of free people, our leaders, our founding fathers, intended to build the foundational premise on which this country would be built on the Ten Commandments and God's laws. They knew God had to play a part in what they were doing and what they were accomplishing. In our story today that we're going to start reading in a moment here, we're going to find the people of Israel have come from the mountain of God, Mount Sinai. They've witnessed something. This is where they were to receive the Ten Commandments and all of the rest of God's instructions about how they're supposed to be living their lives. And the very first words of those directives are what we can read here in Deuteronomy 5, beginning in verse 1. Deuteronomy 5 and verse 1. And Moses called all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your hearing today, that you may learn them and be careful to observe them." It was something that we're going to find out that could save their lives and provide them freedom. Verse 2. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, those who are here today, all of us who are alive. That's who this covenant was made with. And as you recall in the last couple of sermons that I've given, one of the things that Paul told us, all of these scriptures, all of these stories, all of these premises that have been written in the past were written for our benefit, for our admonition, for our learning. So you could say that we were standing right there at the steps where the commandments were given, just like Moses is talking to ancient Israel. He said, "The Lord talked with you," in verse 4, "face to face on the mountain from the midst of the fire. I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up on the mountain." He said, "I am the Lord, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." Other translations translate verse 6 like this: "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." They were brought out of the house of slavery. Once they were slaves. For hundreds of years they were slaves. Now they were a free people. They had been given liberty. God made them free. God's words made them free. Let's go over to Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28. Here in Deuteronomy 28, they are reminded of their 40-year trip to the Promised Land. A land that was intended to be, for them, a land of freedom. But on their way to the land of freedom, God had them stopping here on this other mountain. And he wanted to remind them of a few things. One, about what he told them he wanted them to do with his law, and what he was going to do for them if they lived like that. This is where they were to accept and obey God's law and move forward for the rest of their lives with God's control, protection, and guidance. And this law was going to be the foundation, as we're going to see, for the blessings and the freedom as God's people for eternity. Just like us here in the good old U.S. of A. Just like we can watch and see and still observe in Washington, D.C. Let's pick it up here in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 1. In Deuteronomy 28, God tells them that if they obey his laws, something positive is going to happen in their lives. As you look here and start reading along, I'm going to be reading from another translation. I'm going to be reading from the Holman Christian Standard Bible. Deuteronomy 28, verse 1. "Now, if you faithfully obey the Lord your God and are careful to follow all his commandments I am giving you today, the Lord your God will put you far above all the nations of the earth." Our founding fathers of the United States believed this. That's one of the reasons why when you read documents that came about as a result of what was going on back in the 1770s, almost every document refers to God, refers to the Bible, refers to the sovereignty of God, refers to the power of God, refers to the guidance and protection and direction of God. They knew that if they based what we were going to do in this country on the Bible, on God's commands, on God's guidance, they knew they'd be lifted up as a nation above all nations. They perceived that. And what happened? From 1776 forward, this country became the most powerful nation the earth has ever seen. It became a reality for this country. And they were told back then they would be given positions of prominence if they would just follow and obey God's law. Stick to it. Stick as close to it as you possibly can. Remember the stories of Joseph and Daniel? What happened with them? They stuck to what God taught them. They believed in it. They lived it. They wouldn't abandon it in any way, shape, or form. And what did God do? He raised them up in prominence. And he raised them up in prominence in pagan institutions, pagan worlds. It's what happened to them. Obedience, trust, confidence, and faith in God, and the blessings to be promoted to prominence. That's what God is saying. Do what I'm asking you to do. I'll elevate you above all nations of the earth. Listen to how he elaborates then on what the blessings will be if they will just do what he asks them to do. Verse 2. All these blessings will come and overtake you because you obey the Lord your God. Did you catch that terminology? All these blessings will come and they'll overtake you. When we think of something being overtaken, we think of something just being swarmed, right? Just overwhelmed. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about blessings, just swarms of blessings overwhelming us. He said they'll overtake you. You will be blessed in the city and blessed in the country. Your descendants will be blessed, and your soil's produce will be blessed. And the offspring of your livestock will be blessed, including the young of your herds and the newborn of your flocks. Your basket and kneading bowl will be blessed. You will be blessed when you come in, and you will be blessed when you go out. The Lord will cause the enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you. And in many times, they didn't even have to fight the battles. People started to come in against them. God just destroyed them. Remember Gideon's army? Started out with thousands of men, got down to 300 men. All they did is make a big racket. And it scared them so bad, God caused them to just run. They started killing each other and ran away. The Lord, verse 8, will grant you a blessing. No, the Lord will cause your enemies to rise up against you, in verse 7, to defeat before you. They will march out against you in one direction, but flee from you in seven directions. Chaos. Because God's in control. That's what we've been learning from Daniel, which we've been learning from Joseph, and from the Feast of Pentecost. God's in control of all this, and that power is God's Spirit, and it's living in each and every one of us. God wants us to use it, brethren. He wants us to use it more than we've ever used it before in our lives. It goes on in verse 8, he said, the Lord will grant you a blessing on your storehouses and on everything you do. Everything you do. He will bless you in the land, and the Lord your God is the Lord your God that he's giving you. The Lord will establish you as his holy people, as he swore to you, if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. This is really powerful stuff. I mean, God pulls no punches about how he's willing to bless. And again, I tell you, it's great for ancient Israel back then if they would have listened, which they didn't. But to the degree that they did, they were blessed. The same thing stands true for us today. To the degree that we do, God says, I just want to pour my blessings out on you. And when we start seeing things like that happening in our lives, it starts building confidence, it starts building faith, it starts building trust and agreement with God. Because we can see God so active in our lives, and it excites us. And we keep moving forward even more powerful. Again, here was God promising to Israel that his law would be the foundation on which the freedom and blessings that God was planning to give them would come, all based on God's laws. In my library at home, I've got a book called None of These Diseases. When I was at Ambassador College back in the 70s, it was one of our required readings. They've come out with a new edition of it. It's called None of These Diseases for the 21st Century. It's an interesting book because the author, Macmillan, focuses on God's promises to Israel and how that if they obeyed him, they wouldn't experience the diseases that the rest of the world experience, most specifically Egypt. Mr. Macmillan goes to great lengths to point out the diseases of Israel would be spared if they obeyed God's law that God gave them. And sometimes they didn't even know why they would be spared from these diseases. For example, in our culture, the idea of sexual purity is laughed at, as we can see by the Supreme Court ruling that just took place. And yet sexual purity was a major part of the law focused heavily on by God in Israel. Just read through Deuteronomy, read through Numbers, read through Leviticus. And you see it woven in there all the way around. Since the 1960s, ignoring this kind of behavior, ignoring these kinds of precepts and concepts that God has given all of mankind, mocking God's law on this has created a trauma in this country. Since the 1960s, the number of sexually transmitted diseases have skyrocketed and have become a leading concern in our nation. Let me read you some statistics about STDs in the United States. More than half of all people will have an STD or an STI at some point in their lifetime. Sexually transmitted disease or sexually transmitted infection. Recent estimates from the Centers for Disease Control and Infection show that there are about 20 million new STDs every year in the United States. In 2014, there were an estimated, and keep in mind this estimation is probably low because fewer than one-third of all doctors ever test for STDs. Fewer than one-third ever test. So more than two-thirds of people that go to the doctor never get tested to see if they have it or not. But in spite of that, in 2014, there were estimated to be 110 million prevalent STIs and STDs among men and women in the United States. Of these, more than 20% or 22.1 million were among women and men between the ages of 15 and 24. 22.1 million. The total estimated direct cost of STIs and STDs annually in the United States is $16 billion. Each year, one in four teens contracts an STD or an STI. One in four. One in two sexually active persons will contract an STD by the age of 25. That's what happens when you ignore God's laws on sex. Then there were God's laws concerning cleanliness and sanitation, which could spare Israel and would spare Israel from plagues and from infections. And they weren't even aware of this. They were just told, follow these laws, follow these guidelines. We take much of what the Bible is given us for granted because we, in our culture, we've learned these things already. But they came from the Bible. It didn't come from man just conjuring up in his head, well, maybe this is a good thing to do. It actually started with the Bible. But this hasn't always been the case. Let me share something with you. Back in 1840, the medical center of Europe at that point in time was in Vienna, Austria. If you had a disease or an illness that was really bad, this was the place to go for the most cutting edge in medical care, Vienna, Austria. In that day, there was a young doctor stationed there named Ignaz Semmelweis. His area of oversight was the maternity ward of the hospital in Vienna. But there was a problem there that deeply concerned him. The percentage of deaths in the ward was extremely high. One out of every six women, one out of every six women died of what was called childbed fever. And no satisfactory explanation seemed to be found by anybody. So Semmelweis decided to watch the doctors who treated the women in the maternity ward and observed what they did all day long. He discovered that the other physicians' first stop in the morning was always the morgue. They would examine dead bodies. Of course, there were no rubber gloves back in those days, and no doctors ever washed their hands because they didn't see the need for it. Nobody thought it was necessary. Once they'd finished examining the corpses, they would make their way up to the maternity ward to examine all of the pregnant women. Today, you and I can understand why there'd been such a high death rate in that kind of an ward with expectant mothers knowing what kind of activities taking place. But Semmelweis was the first doctor to realize this connection between the two wards. So what he did is he began to institute a strict regimen of hand washing from all the doctors before they ever examined any live patients. Soon after he implemented this, the death rate went from 1 in 6 to less than 1 in 100. Now, you would think with this kind of an achievement that the doctors and nurses and everybody would just be heralding him. Not so. The medical establishment was enraged by this inconvenience and burden of having to wash their hands every time they had an interaction with a live human being. After a short while, he was fired by the hospital because of the problems that he created. A little while later, he was hired by another hospital in another country. Again, he saw this horrific death rate. He implemented the constitution of regimen of hand washing, rigorous hand washing. As soon as he implemented this, the death rate just plummeted. And again, the medical staff became angry and ultimately fired him. Two hospitals. It's back in the 1840s, 1841, 42, 43. It wasn't until Louis Pasteur confirmed what is called the germ theory years later that Semmelweis's ideas began to be endorsed by doctors around the world. But centuries before, interestingly enough, God had declared that anybody who touched a dead body was unclean for 7 days. Nobody knew why. God didn't talk about germs. God didn't talk about bacteria. God didn't talk about infections. And touching any kind of a dead carcass required someone to wash themselves completely and all of their clothes. Again, they didn't know anything about bacteria. They didn't know anything about germs and infection. All they knew is if they did these things, they were spared diseases. You can find both the answers to both of those in Numbers 19 and Numbers 11. Let's flip back to Exodus 19 now. Exodus 19. The people of Israel observed these laws without understanding anything about all of this medical stuff, the germs, the bacteria, the viruses, and all that kind of stuff. And as long as they followed God's guidelines and God's laws, they kept disease and sicknesses out of the camp. They didn't know why, but it just happened. In obeying these simple rules, they actually avoided many plagues and diseases that troubled other nations that they came in contact with regularly. God knew what he was doing, even though they didn't. So to go back, God had brought them to Mount Sinai to receive his law after freeing them from Egypt. Again, the law that would be the basis for their freedom and the many blessings that God promised them as his people. If they obeyed his law and followed in his ways, they would remain free people and be blessed like crazy. But when they go back to the giving of the law, where that was actually done on Mount Sinai, God did what appears to be some pretty dramatic displays of fireworks. Let's begin here in Exodus 19 and verse 16. Exodus 19 and verse 16. Then as it came to pass on the third day, as they prepared for the Lord to come down and give them this, in the morning, that there were thunderings and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. This scared them, what they witnessed and what they heard. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. So here's the mountain in front of them, which God told them, don't touch the mountain. Don't come past a certain guideline. Come down, and you can witness me, God, coming down and talking to you, my people. Now, Mount Sinai was completely in smoke in verse 18 because the Lord descended upon it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. Think about that for a minute. Israel had come to this mountain to be given their freedom, if you will, the foundation of their freedom, God's laws. He told them, you follow my laws, I'll give you blessings. And freedom should be celebrated, like with fireworks, wouldn't you agree? I mean, isn't that what we do in this country? Every year, people go out and watch fireworks, 4th of July, it's the big thing, Independence Day. Flip over a few pages to chapter 20, maybe one or two pages. So what we see here is God sets off his own kind, his own form of fireworks. God has a display. an independence display, a freedom. These are freedom fireworks. See, God created freedom fireworks. Listen to how the people of God reacted after giving the Ten Commandments here in Exodus 20. Let's look at Exodus 20 and verse 18. Exodus 20 and verse 18. All the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when they saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. They wanted to stay as far away from that as they possibly could. It terrified them. Then they said to Moses, "Moses, you speak to us, and we're going to listen. But don't let God speak to us. We know we'll die if we let that happen." And God sets off his fireworks. But these are so scary of a fireworks display that it scares the people and tremble, and they fear for their lives. Keep in mind that this is the place that Israel was going to be given its foundational premises for their free freedom forever. But where's the celebration? Where's the excitement? Where's the Freedom and Independence Day festivities? Where's the barbecues? Where's the hot dogs? Where's the hamburgers? Why on earth would God create such an ominous and scary atmosphere for the giving of his law? A law intended to give freedom and a law intended to give blessings. Mark your place in Exodus 20 here and turn over to Deuteronomy 9 real quick. Deuteronomy chapter 9. Again, why would God come on with this kind of a display for these people? Why wasn't it a celebratory occasion? I mean, God's giving him his Ten Commandments. God's giving him his guide and direction of life. God's giving them the foundational basis for their freedom and their blessings. Well, I can think of a very good reason why God's display came across this way. The reason? God knew them. God knew their hearts. Let me show you what I mean. At one point, while Israel was still in the desert, Moses had to chastise the ancient Israelites many times because of their constant bickering. They were never satisfied. They were never happy. They were always complaining about something. I'm sure we all recall this here in Deuteronomy 9. Let's actually pick it up in Deuteronomy 9 in verse 6. And look at how Moses describes them. Deuteronomy 9 verse 5, actually. Just start in verse 5. He said, "It is not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you go in to possess their land, the land that God was going to give them. It's because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord your God drives them out before you, and that he may fulfill the word which he swore, which the Lord swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." He said, you're not getting this because you deserve this. You're not getting this because you're such good people. On the contrary, you're getting this because you just happen to be here when the descendants' promises are going to come down to the people. Therefore, understand in verse 6 that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness. For you are a stiff-necked people. You people are a pain in the backside. It bothered Moses. Moses kept going to God and saying, well, how long do I have to put up with this? You ask me to lead your people up, and all they do is complain and bellyache and moan. He said, this is driving me crazy. God knew this about them. Also, he says, in Horeb, you provoked the Lord to wrath. You made God so angry, God wanted to kill all of you. Moses didn't go on and say this, but he could have said, I had to talk him out of it. God really wanted to destroy you because of the way you behave and the way you act. God knew their hearts. He knew they'd be hard-hearted. He knew they'd be rebellious. He knew they'd provoke him by their behavior time and time again. So when he brought them to the base of the mountain to give them his commandments, his guidelines for life, his directions on how to live your life and get blessed and be protected, he puts on a really scary light show and sound show. He's basically telling them, I'm God, you're not. Get used to it. I'm in charge here, and you need to understand that. Back to Exodus 20. Back to Exodus 20. He was telling them that those commandments he was about to give them were commandments, not suggestions. They didn't get to vote on them, and they couldn't pick which ones they wanted to live by or not live by. It was an all or nothing deal. But why say that to them in this fashion? Well, because people tend to bend the rules for their own advantage. And God knew that about the ancient Israelites. If I didn't tell them they had to follow every single word of this and get it really into their hearts, they'd look for a loophole somewhere and they'd probably find one. A few months ago in Reader's Digest, there was an interesting article about cheating and just manipulating people. The article discussed what prompted people to cheat and how they justify it. According to the Josephson Institute, which did the research, here's what few points that they discovered in their research. Those with power or the better office felt they had a right to steal and to cheat more than anybody else in the organization. Those who hung around with others who cheated and stole were more likely to do so themselves. Those who felt that another person had cheated often felt that it was only fair that they quote-unquote level the playing field by cheating and stealing from the wrongdoers, totally justifying their behavior. And those who had gotten used to minor infractions in the younger life grew into larger infractions later in life. They found that rule breaking worsens over time as opposed to getting better with maturity. As they put it, kids who cheat in high school exams are 3 times as likely in adulthood to lie to a customer or to inflate an insurance claim compared with non-cheaters. What I found interesting in the article was an admission by one of the behavioral scientists and economists named David Ehrlich at Duke University. He was involved in this study, and some of the stuff that he brought up was buried way at the back end of the report. Ehrlich noted this: if test subjects were made to recall the Ten Commandments before they took a test, they were much less likely to cheat. And researchers found that this worked even among the non-religious people. In other words, when the people were simply made to think about God's laws, they were less likely to justify and embrace sinful tendencies like cheating and stealing. What does that tell you? It tells me the power of the living words of God. Just hearing them, just thinking about them, even non-religious people, it affects them. Let's look at Exodus 20 and pick it up where we left off. Exodus 20 and verse 20, and I'm going to be reading here from the New Living Translation, so it might be a little different than yours. Exodus 20, verse 20. Moses said, "Don't be afraid, for God has come in this way to show you his awesome power." You need to understand he's in charge. You need to understand he's the power of the universe. "From now on, let your fear of him, because of this display that you saw, keep you from sinning." As his people stood in the distance, Moses entered into the deep darkness where God was. And the Lord said to Moses, "Say this to the people of Israel: you are witnesses that I have spoken to you from heaven." You got the point. I intended to scare you. I intended to make you tremble. I intended to get your attention. You need to pay attention to what I just told you. God knew the hearts of the Israelites. And he knows our hearts as well. And that's one of the reasons he made such an imposing and frightening display on the mountain that day. He had to get their attention. He had to remind them of his power and his being the one in control. As we get ready to close, let's go back to one of the scriptures we looked at the beginning, Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28. all the attention getting that God did at Mount Sinai was for a very good reason. It would be good for us to listen and to learn, because he wants to bless us as well. It wasn't just for them. And this type of living, when we do it on a regular basis, creates trust. It creates confidence, creates faith in God. Because we live it and we see the results of it, the positive results of it. Just as we saw in the lives of Joseph and Daniel recently. Let's pick it up in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 2 again. All these blessings will come and overtake you because you obey the Lord your God. You will be blessed in the city. You'll be blessed in the country. Your descendants will be blessed, and your soil's produce, and the offspring of your livestock, including the young of your herds and the newborn of your flocks. Your basket and kneading bowl will be blessed. You'll be blessed when you come in, and you will be blessed when you go out. The Lord will cause the enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you. They will march out against you in one direction. They will flee from you in seven directions. The Lord will grant you a blessing on your storehouses and on everything you do. He will bless you in the land the Lord your God is giving to you. The Lord will establish you as his holy people, as he swore to you, if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. So, if you happen to go out watching fireworks tonight, as you see that display of fireworks before you and you go the ooh and the ah, let it remind you of the fireworks at Mount Sinai for God to get our attention to listen to what he had to say to us. Enjoy the rest of the 4th.